Imagine a world where innovation knows no bounds. At BAE Systems Fast Labs, we're pioneering advanced technology and defense research, shaping the future of safety and security. Explore our website to uncover a realm of cutting-edge projects, collaborations, and visionary thinkers. Whether you're a tech enthusiast, a defender of freedom, or just curious, Fast Labs is where groundbreaking solutions are born. Join us and be part of the future today. Visit www.baesystems.com/fastlabs. Welcome to From the Crow's Nest, a podcast on electromagnetic spectrum operations, or EMSO. I'm your host, Ken Miller, Director of Advocacy and Outreach for the Association of Old Crows. Thanks for listening. In this episode, I am pleased to be here with Association of Old Crows President Brian Hinckley. Retired Navy Captain Brian Hinckley has served the EW community for over 40 years, and he currently is the Vice President for Amentum. He is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy back in 1983 and earning his wings of gold in 1984. And then he spent 26 years as electronic countermeasures officer in naval aviation. Some of the highlights of his career were that he was a commanding officer of VAQ-135, the Black Ravens, for Operation Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom, and his selection in 2006 as the first operational commander for Joint Crew Composite Squadron 1. So long career in EW, super knowledgeable guy. It's always been great to sit down and talk with him, and I am pleased to have him here on From the Crow's Nest today. Hinks, thanks for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest.
Well, thanks for having me, Ken. It's always great to be had. Hello, crows and future crows.
So we are actually together this week at an industry conference up here in rainy Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. It's been a very good week of briefings, but it's been really good to kind of engage you on some of the topics. And I thought it'd be a good opportunity to sit down with you and just kind of talk about a little bit about what we're learning. And as we were doing that, I was thinking, I believe our first interaction, our substantive interaction, was back in 2006. I was working on a report for the Congressional Electronic Warfare Working Group. It was called the Future of EW Report. And that report was released back like 2006, 2007. But I asked you to take a look at the rough draft of it. And you gave me a lot of your recommendations. And the report basically broke down in terms of the future of EW, we need three strategic goals. The first was leadership. The second was investment in critical technologies. And the third was force readiness, including training and intellectual capital. And as I was rereading that before our interview today, I was thinking back, and like, it's now 17 years later, and we kind of are talking about the exact same thing. So I thought it'd be a good way to introduce the conversation, get your thoughts on where have we come in 17 years if we were talking about these issues all the way back then.
No, I think that's a great point, Ken. While it's easy to get a little frustrated in that we haven't made the progress that we were hoping to have made by now, I think there's a lot happening. There's a lot of things coming together right now where we're showing some significant progress in all three of those areas more recently than we have in many, many years.
So with that, you know, during this week at the stakeholder conference, you know, we received briefings on a number of issues ranging from kind of what's going on in Ukraine to, you know, our readiness in the PACOM region. Where do you see us succeeding in EMSO today? And what are some of the persistent gaps that we really still need to make sure we're paying attention to?
Primarily, where we're succeeding, the evidence of that is that people are starting to understand the criticality of EW and EMSO in every combat action around the world. General Casey recently said it best, I think. He said, we're gridlocked in colossal global dysfunction. And everywhere you look, we're struggling. And people are winning. They're gaining at a decisive tactical advantage in the electromagnetic spectrum with asymmetric kind of capabilities. So I think that heightened awareness, the appreciation of what this community brings to the fight is a wonderful thing. It's unfortunate that it took a catastrophic forcing function to get us there. But You know, now we're seeing every handheld anti-drone devices, backpack size jammers and detectors, mobile sites, fixed systems. We're using non-kinetic weapons to affect, you know, non-kinetic fires for that tactical advantage, and it's coming at a lower cost. So I think there's a lot of goodness there.
So in your presentation, your slides, one of the slides I really liked was you had some quotes about, and it was a kind of a game that you played with the audience, you know, when was this said and by who? And some of the quotes were about how the next battles were going to be won in the electromagnetic spectrum. Some of those quotes date back to 1950s by Soviet Union, I think the 80s or sometime with you know, the People's Republic of China. And then, of course, you know, the last was the U.S. So it's just kind of painted this picture of, you know, this has been, we've been talking about the need or the electromagnetic operating environment being the backbone of mission success for decades. Moving forward here, you know, I want to kind of pull the thread on terms of what lessons do you think that we are learning from the current global mess that we are currently in when you're looking at all the conflicts in the Middle East and Ukraine? These are electromagnetic warfare battles, largely. I mean, yes, there's other regular forms of fires, but all that is enabled by electronic warfare. So what are a couple of things that we're learning that we need to kind of put into practice?
You know, it's interesting, Ken, as I was sitting in the conference yesterday, there was a presentation by the Air Force, right? And we're looking at our pacing threat being China. And as they talked about how the Air Force was preparing for that, they were using almost the exact sentences that we use for electronic warfare and EMSO for years now, and yet they were talking about kinetic weapons. So they said we're going to have to attain a temporary degree of air superiority to achieve mission effect in the contested battle space at a time and location required by theater commanders. I mean, we've been saying that for years. We need to be able to control the electromagnetic spectrum at a time and place of our choosing and to deny our adversaries the same. So it's interesting how we're looking at things, but they did mention, just on the other hand, kind of on an equal billing, achieving EMS superiority and making sure that they're way ahead, they cannot ignore that. So I think they correctly pointed out that any emission on in any battle space now, you know, it will be detected, it will be tracked, and it'll be used to target forces. So I think the more we invest in that, I think the better off we are. So that was kind of a big force look at China. I think we realize that it's going to be a very difficult to match them aircraft for aircraft or missile for missile or ship for ship. So again, electronic warfare EMSO capabilities, the asymmetric concepts and capabilities that are being developed, we'll use that to disrupt an enemy's A2AD, to disrupt their defenses, and quite honestly, you know, increase our survivability. And that's something that struck me as not much different than what we've talked about since, you know, back in 2006 when we were talking. I mean, to be honest, back in the 80s, we were talking about suppression of enemy air defenses. We were talking about defeating Assyrian IADs. So it's the concepts are not new, but I think the focus on it by non-EWMSO people, the kinetic warfighters, is something that we're seeing that's pretty new. Let me add just a couple things, you know, because there are a couple other areas other than China. China's not 10 feet tall, and there's a lot going on around the rest of the world. You know, in the Red Sea, near and dear to my heart, as a Navy guy, there have been over two dozen anti-ship ballistic missiles fired at U.S. warships, something that never happened in my lifetime in uniform. Probably another dozen anti-ship cruise missiles, the Mahan, the Gravely. There's a number of ships that are in the Red Sea. probably twice as many, probably four dozen one-way attack UAVs in the Red Sea from the Houthis and stuff. So my son just returned from deployment on the Gravely. So I think we're in a position in the world where these non-state actors, these terrorist organizations, no longer is it inconceivable to fire against a U.S. warship. So that's very concerning. And then, of course, the other two big areas that are going on around the world, Israel, Palestine, Gaza, we're seeing a lot of great EW capability kind of emerge from that, right? Monopulse backpackable electronic attack, something called M-Beam, which is basically a laser that can be used by soldiers, or you can put it on drones, right? To gives you kind of an infinite magazine. You're not going to run out of kinetic weapons with laser technology. I think that there's something called the Scorpius G, which is a ground-based AESA-based thing, and we'll talk a little bit, I know, about what's facing industry in the future, and we can talk a little bit more about gallium nitride and what that brings to the fight. And then, of course, is I think we're into our third year of the Russian invasion in Ukraine, and the Russian, it's a cat and mouse as to who is using electronic warfare and EMSO better on any given week or month out there in that battlefield. The Ukrainians were making a pretty big dent in the Russian forces by use of their drones. And then the Russians figured it out, and they just, you know, they looked at the drones themselves, and they were off the shelf. They were sometimes limited to a single frequency, and the Russians figured it out, started jamming those drones, and then were able to re-seize the advantage on that battlefield. So I do think there's a lot of stuff going on right now that is really raising the visibility of what we do.
And, you know, one of the challenges over the years has always been to make sure that we're prepared for the next fight without some sort of catastrophic failure or problem where we face something that we're not anticipating. I think one of the things you mentioned a lot of things, but these are successes too. When you're looking at, you know, the Houthis firing on U.S. ships, you know, might never have happened before, but they're not being successful in doing it either. So, you know, electronic warfare is proving once again that it's requirement in terms of fighting. You do mention the industry. You know, like one of the joys of working in this space is just, it's not just the mind-blowing technology that's out there. So, I mean, some of the things that we can do is just mind-boggling, but the talent, the people that are putting this technology together, the minds that are kind of working through some of the problems, we have a great U.S. defense industrial base, but we need to make sure that that industrial base is able to sustain itself and continue to provide our warfighters the technology. So, you know, at this conference this week, you know, we're talking about some of these challenges facing the industrial base. What are some of the things that stood out to you in terms of our EW stakeholders and industry are facing on a daily basis that we need to kind of keep in mind and work on?
No, boy, that's a difficult question because we're facing so many different kinds of combat around the world. You know, when we look at the threat, we've got sea skimming missiles, we've got enemies that now certainly understand electromagnetic warfare and EMSO. So they're using high power imaging radars, both in aircraft and long range surveillance and defense radars on their coastlines. And I think, you know, we have to understand the threat, because all of that technology there's a great potential of that falling into the hands of these rogue nations and non-state actors, which just severely complicate the problem. I think industry has to be open to a hybrid collaboration of older proven technology, maybe in like the VETs and you know, vacuum tubes. And I think as well as kind of the competing use of solid state technologies. But just like golf balls or anything else, I mean, sometimes you use one kind of a golf ball if you want to hit the ball farther, you use another kind of a golf ball to be softer around the greens. I think, again, there's probably some great solutions out there if we can work together across different technologies. I would say our acquisition procurement system is still badly in need of reform. That's not a new statement. I think I've heard that for at least 40 years. But it's clear that we do have to go to smaller and more disposable weapons. There will always be size, weight, and power and cooling restrictions and challenges. But as we see in Ukraine, I mean, the logistics trail behind that should be a big consideration for our industry partners as well, to consider that and then to take advantage of some of the new stuff that's out there that I think eventually just reduces manufacturing costs, whether it's 3D printing or digital engineering, or I see those requirements coming down now. So I think there's a great potential. We're learning new things every day. Everybody learns. I think the Russians and the were learning. The Iranians were learning as they watched the U.S. fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now the Houthis and the Hamas are learning as they watch combat around the world.
Hello, everyone. I want to take a short break to thank BAE Systems Fast Labs for the continued support for our From the Crow's Nest podcast. I am pleased to be here today with Bill Watson, Chief Scientist at BAE Systems Fast Labs. Bill, it's great to be here with you. Now, BAE Systems Fast Labs is BAE Systems Research and Development and Production Organization. Can you tell us a little bit about Fast Labs as well as your background?
Yes, and thank you for having me. BAE Systems Fast Labs is dedicated to innovating disruptive next-generation solutions for the critical defense and intelligence challenges. Of course, electronic warfare is one of our key focus areas, but in addition to that, we also do research in autonomy and AI, sensing and response, advanced microelectronics, communications, and navigation. I've been working in the RF, that is radio frequency research community, for over 20 years, a short time in the United States Air Force, followed by specific research and development. My work in the last 20 years has been singularly focused on DARPA research, and within the last 10 years at BAE Systems Fast Labs specifically. Technology we work on spans sensor processing to high-level sense-making, up to tactical and operational-level autonomy and decision-making support. And one of the key differentiators about BAE Fast Labs is the research that we do is intended to find its way to benefit the warfighter.
This has been an important topic through many of our recent episodes here on From the Crow's Nest. Can you talk a little bit more about that technology? And for our audience, how does it change or affect our EW capabilities that we're trying to field?
In our work with leading DoD customers like DARPA or AFRL, we focus on developing technologies that will advance future solutions, from overcoming today's challenges to developing technologies never before thought to be possible. We then transition our technology to fieldable products to benefit our warfighters through partnership with BAE Systems Electronic Systems product lines. As a specific example, I thought I'd use a movie you may or may not be familiar with. It was called Battle Los Angeles. It was from 2011. And in that movie, aliens it had invaded. And what the characters in the movie found is that whenever they keyed their microphones on their radios, they could be easily geolocated and targeted. What the movie presented as science fiction for us is, in fact, science fact. This is the type of technology that we work on and exist today, where the physics meets the real world.
This sounds like absolutely fascinating work. What is the next area that you see for research and development? And if anyone is interested in learning more, how can they reach out to you?
Well, we can't say too much because of the sensitivity of our work, classification levels. But in Fast Labs, we are always working on the future state. No matter what the future threats are, we will continue to focus on solving the hardest problems to benefit the warfighter. If you're interested in more information about Fast Labs, you can connect with us on our website at basystems.com/fastlabs.
Well, thank you, Bill, for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. And now it's time to get back to our show.
Yeah, and I think, getting to your point, I think it's imperative that we have a system, an acquisition system, a technology development protocol that really allows for the greatest agility because we never really know what's on the horizon. We may think that we have the key to the next greatest technology, but we've never reached the end of that. I mean, there's always going to be a counter technology. There's always going to be a counter tactic. And so a lot of times I feel like, you know, what was talked about with some of the industry challenges is that let's not get all on the bandwagon behind one specific technology and keep an open mind where there could be some uses for technology that we've thought we've moved on from, thinking, you know, power tubes and so forth. Because, you know, as we're seeing in this congested, contested spectrum, you know, as we go up into millimeter wave, as we go into space, certain things that we thought were maybe the panacea don't quite do what we thought they were going to do as we expand the requirement to and that agility to go low band to high band. And so keeping that kind of in the system so that we can have constant competition, get away from the sole source contracting, I think is a good thing because the threat is changing on a daily basis. What do you see from an AOC perspective? What can the Association of Old Crows do to kind of encourage some of this at DoD leadership? We talk a lot about, you know, kind of what Congress is doing. There's been some good stuff in Congress in the last year's National Defense Authorization Act, some of the language on there's a whole chapter on electromagnetic warfare. You know, we're talking this year, you know, about some of the oversight that's needed for the implementation of the EMS superiority strategy, particularly in governance. What are some of the things that you think the AOC can do to kind of help make sure that we stay on the right path?
Well, I think the first and foremost mission of the AOC is to represent all of our members and to be the association, the premier professional association, to be the advocate for this community. So I think it's very important. Electrons don't care what organization, association you're from. They don't care what color your uniform is. And we need to take that same approach. I think the Association of Old Crows needs to be more collaborative with the other associations that are interested in helping our military in the electromagnetic spectrum. So I think that's going to be a good piece to go forward with higher collaboration. I think it's important that for all, both national and international, you know, defense departments, governments, industry, and academia, that we engage the leadership, that we discuss their strategies and ensure that we're synced up. I mean, the AOC clearly has a five-year strategy, and we've been holding consistently to that and showing some great progress, investing in the AOC and some folks to get at what we want to do with STEM and education and training. So I think syncing up and being a little bit more transparent, kind of like the battle space is now, more distributive, more networked in who we see as who we should be advocating with. And one thing that was mentioned this week, which I really appreciated, was the potential of bringing an AOC kind of offsite to bring industry together with us to help synchronize our strategies.
One of the things that we've seen, you know, when we do these, we just had a workshop down in San Antonio last month, and, you know, similar types of meetings is when you get the right people in the room, you're aware of not just what you can accomplish, but how basically poor or lacking the communication between these stakeholders has been, and they need that environment with a player like Association of Old Crows or other associations, kind of bring people together in the room and say, "Hey, okay, we're gonna close the door and we're gonna talk about this stuff." And good ideas come out of that, and good action plans come out of that. But sometimes you just need to take that step, and because you can't assume that they are talking on a daily basis.
That's a good point, Ken.
So you mentioned earlier, just in your answer about, you know, the talent kind of going through the community, and I want to talk a little bit about that pipeline concept. You know, We talk about intellectual capital. We have a lot of, you know, our community is filled with so many smart people. But at the end of the day, we have a hard time kind of making sure that we have a constant flow from younger demographics coming in through high school and college, interest in this trade space. There's not an RF, I don't think there's an RF engineering degree. We don't teach, you know, vacuum electronics anymore, even though there is a college on vacuum electronics over in China, a degree that you can get, you know, and they require that. So other people are doing it, but we don't seem to quite have that pipeline going. What are your thoughts on how the state of the talent pipeline? What are some of the things that AOC is doing to kind of help that talent pipeline open up a little bit? And just your general thoughts on kind of where we need to go.
So it's no surprise to anybody that's ever led anything that your people are always your greatest asset. And it concerns me greatly that we are losing our highly trained personnel in some of these industry areas. Not only are they aging out, in the case of like traveling wave tubes and some of the technologies that were in the EA-6B when I was flying around, but you know, there's not a lot of it's tough to compete with attracting people into the defense industry. Sometimes and things are, with all the social media that's out there and all the cyber focus, it's drawing a lot of great talent, which is a wonderful thing, but it's also it comes at a cost to the folks that we need as well in our community. You're correct. I don't know of an RF engineering degree, and yet we're seeing every day, unfortunately, how important it is. Everything that these people do, I can tell you, EW saves lives in combat. And everybody that's working on an EW MSO system contributes directly to that and should be very proud of it. I think we need to, you know, keep STEM front and center into everything that we do. Not only you've got to start early, I mean, it just exposing grade school folks into things that would keep them on the engineering side. Folks in high school, well, I was down at Dixie Crow and they had a great, that's also the center of the National STEM Academy down there.
They have a great program down there.
They do. And we had a good meeting. We talked about it. But the local kids were, they brought in their robotics and they were getting ready for a state competition. They were very excited about it. But it was interesting to see them. And it was highly encouraging because they're great kids and they're very, very talented. And then we started talking about, okay, we also have kind of another couple levels of STEM, right? We have kids that are freshmen and sophomore in college as they choose their degree and how that would contribute to national defense. And then you've got your junior and senior year in college where you're looking for internships and you're looking for your career path. And so I think there's opportunity there to make that linkage and to teach and to show people how electronic warfare is and electromagnetic spectrum operations are contributing to the national defense and how important that is to their future and the future of our country. I think that might be a good way to start.
One of the conversations I've had with congressional staff so forth this year has been, you know, trying to get this type of education into some of the service academies, the service schools, some of the training, so that, you know, as you come in, regardless of where you come into and regardless of where your military career takes you, you're first and foremost getting a lesson at some basic level about the fact that you are operating in the electromagnetic environment. And electromagnetic spectrum operations touches on what you do. Even if you're infantry, you are still affected by electromagnetic spectrum operations and trying to get that into. What are your thoughts on like trying to move forward in that direction where we're just at every time we have a service school at a service track, education track, that we're teaching that?
No, that's critical. But I mean, there's very few of those, right? I mean, I think that should be that's a baby step, but it should be a guaranteed step one. I can't imagine a military academy that would be opposed, looking at combat around the world, that would be opposed to ramping up education and those things. I think you walk into a fifth grade classroom and you take away their cell phones, and I think they'll appreciate what the electromagnetic spectrum does and doesn't do. People don't realize how reliant we all are on the electromagnetic spectrum. We assume it away like we assume away oxygen. And until we run out of it, it's a challenge we'll have to continue to fight.
We have one more day of this conference. We have some breakout sessions to get to. So, you know, we're a little bit time constrained. Just as a final question, you know, you're in your second year. I think I had you back on when you were early on in your presidency or just before you took office or sometime. Second year here. Can you give us a little bit of a state of the AOC here in your second term, what you hope to accomplish in the final months of your term?
Sure. Yeah, I will end up in December. Tony Lasuzzo coming in behind me. It'll be great for the AOC. I have I followed Powder Carlson. So between Powder and I, we were both operators first and foremost. I love the fact that we can bring combat-proven warfighters together with engineering and technical and industry leaders as well. So I think that that's been an important part of what I've been contributing and what I hope to continue to contribute. The advocacy, engaging with senior leaders. We were blessed to have Admiral Kaler, who's now out in Compact Fleet, and the Secretary of the Navy, the Honorable Carlos del Toro. We were blessed to have them at our EW symposium last year in December. You know, this year in December, we'll have another 3,000 folks, probably over 150, maybe 200 vendors on the floor. It's going to be great. I mean, that's obviously, we've got our eyes set on that because that truly contributes across the board with education. So that's something we want to continue to build, Ken, as I close out my presidency. But I'll tell you, I'm certainly encouraged that the NDAA mentions, you know, it's the first time in history we've got a chapter dedicated to electromagnetic warfare. And it does include quite a bit of language in there for EMSO readiness and holding the COCOMs and the service chiefs accountable. I've seen a lot of that doctrine and policy in the past. So where the rubber hits the road is when things get funded or not, or they don't get funded. So I'm encouraged by the fact that it's in there, and I hope we don't get all caught up in the lexicon and in the rooms where there are not EW warfighters. They spend more time arguing about whether EW is part of EMSO or EMSO is part of EW, or whether EW includes just electronic attack or SIGINT and directed energy and lasers and high-powered microwave. I mean, I understand it's a confusing lexicon, but I hope it doesn't complicate the fact that we need to invest in it, and it is absolutely critical to the defense of our country and to readiness across the board. So I think that's kind of the goal, is where we're headed, and we'll continue to hold people's leadership feet to the fire to be able to support that.
Well, thanks, Hinks, for joining me here from the Crow's Nest. It's always good to sit down and chat with you about this stuff, and I appreciate you taking time out to join me.
My pleasure, Ken. Thank you very much, and all crows have a great day.
Well, that will conclude this episode of From the Crow's Nest. I want to thank my guest, retired Navy Captain and AOC President Brian Hinckley. Please don't forget to review, share, and follow the show. We always enjoy hearing from our listeners, so please take a moment and let us know how we're doing. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Fast Labs, powered by BAE Systems, is at the forefront of advanced technology and defense research, development, and production. They're pushing boundaries, breaking barriers, and innovating for a safer world. Check them out at www.baesystems.com/fastlabs.